Accession number 8657, rule number 4.
Mr. Green, rule 4. What happened to you then and the battalion after the West Yorkshires took over the...
Well, we was pulled out of Abyssinia altogether. We was pulled out of Sudan altogether. And we went down to Port Suez in Egypt again, keeping our hands crossed, going home, which we did think this time we were going home. But got re-equipped out, changed all our stuff again, like, you know, new gear and all that wanted it and things like that, because, I mean, we were pretty dirty and rugged sort of thing. And on the boat we got, instead of going back the other way through the Suez, we went back through the other way through the Dead Sea out in the Indian Ocean, and next we heard we was on our way to Rangoon, Burma.
How long did it take you, do you think, to recover fully from being on campaign in East Africa?
Not long, no way, because I've been so used to it. I mean, you've got to realise, I mean, I was a young man, okay, I was pretty healthy at the time. And I joined up on the 1st of January 1933. I joined the battalion, I went abroad, and I was on active service. I've been on active service right the way through. From the time practically I joined the battalion and went abroad in 1935, I'd been on active service right up until 45. That was 10 years active service, over 10 years active service. I lived in a desert. I more or less made a desert my own. I lived in it. I've been in squalor and I've been in good places. I mean, anybody, I think, you know, they can, if they can adapt themselves to it, can do it. I wouldn't say I do it today, mind you. I mean, not at my age, no way. But I think if anybody can do it out in the desert and they can adapt themselves to it out in the desert, I think they stand a good chance. They get by. I did.
What about the other men in the battalion? Were they the same sort of
mind? Yes, near enough, because we'd all been out as a body from England. We'd gone straight from England, straight out to Palestine as a body, as a whole battalion. The whole battalion went out, and we'd gone out as a battalion. And we was made up with personnel from our 2nd battalion that had come from India, and we was made up with certain batches of those that joined us in Palestine on the way home from India. Because the 2nd Battalion had been in India since the end of 1918. They'd been out there quite a few years.
And how did they fit in with your lot?
Quite well, because there again, they'd been used to it again, because they'd been up the northwest frontier of India. Because I'd been up there with them. On one time, I was up there for about 6 months at first. And then I came back. But it seemed funny with our battalions. I mean, OK, we've got the two main battalions, the 1st and 2nd Essex. But had all been on active service, even before war broke out. See, the 2nd Battalion was up in the northwest frontier of India, fighting up here, at Landakotal and places like that. The 1st Battalion, OK, when we went abroad, we was in Palestine. That was our first lot of operations out there. So... and we was on active service, so everything was whether it come desert or not, because we was used to desert. We was always out in the desert.
Did the trouble at Gallabat have any effect on morale immediately afterwards?
Well, yes. There was two incidents which I could tell you, which were very sad incidents, really. After we took this fort, and because you know they came out running, as I told you. It's a bit of misfortune. And I met up with a couple of blokes that come up to our echelon, which we was about 2 miles from the fort at the time, because I'd brought the cook's lorries out, because we couldn't stay in there.
Too small, was it?
The fort was too small. Well, it was really small. And he had one courtyard, which the Italians knew quite well, sort of thing. So, I mean, I suppose we could have camouflaged them, but it's no good having a water lorry and a cook's wagon blown up in the air for nothing, was it? So we came out. Well, these chaps that came out, Nobby Smeaton was one. I think his name was Nobby Smeaton. Company Tow Law. Nice young chap. Great billiard player. He was down. Very down, depressed in it. And anyhow, he had a cup of tea, sat around with me around the stove and it, having a drink of a cup of tea. Took a cold tea, matter of fact, because I didn't like hot tea at the time. It was always cold tea. I had a black Dixie on the go. No matter what was in it, I used to drink it. And I remember turning around saying, "What's up?" He said, I could say an army style, like, you know, but it was a bit fed up, sort of thing. So, anyhow, it come to, and that, you know, I've been sitting around for 3 or 4 hours at dark. I said, "I'm going to turn in." So he got in, laid in the middle of me. I was on the outside, he was in the middle of another bloke there. Very sad. And, very early in the morning, still dark. And I heard him moving about beside me, sort of thing, didn't dream what was wrong. I had my back turned to him. And lucky, really, I don't know what actually happened. Lucky I never caught it, but I was well smothered in blood. He'd put the rifle in his mouth and pulled the trigger. He blew his head right off.
And he committed suicide depressed about
it. He was depressed. It was the only one that we had, really. He was real depressed, yeah. And he was a nice young chap and all, really.
Was anything done?
Because what actually done it, what was going around at the time, was that he couldn't face it because the rumour went round after we evacuated the fort, because we evacuated it after we had it as more or less a no man's land. And the rumour was going around that the Italians had brought up their big heavy guns. And I think that's what scared him. And he was scared.
Was anything done by the battalion officers to try and raise morale and restore
it? Oh, morale wasn't actually down, not all that much. No, I mean, morale was pretty well up, I will say that, because, I mean, 90% of them blokes had all been through it before. We'd all been through it. We'd all had our ups and downs in it and hardships. We'd all been over the desert. I mean, we travelled all the way from Khartoum to down to where we was, over 120 odd mile away, sort of thing, at the time. I mean, and we'd been out in the desert, we'd been up in the desert, back and down, up again, back again. Oh, we'd all been under it. So, no, I mean, you do get fed up. There's no getting away from it. I mean, at times you do get fed up. I mean, especially if you're laying around and wondering what's happening and what ain't happening, sort of thing. But anyhow, no, news went out. I think that's what actually upset quite a couple of them, or a few of them, that the Italians had brought up some heavy artillery, because we had nothing.
How much did you know about what was happening on a wider basis? I mean, was there any way in which you could keep in touch with news, local news or news?
No, that was Interbrook. We had a news sheet, didn't we? Interbrook, we had a news sheet used to come out. I'm not quite certain now. I couldn't say certain whether we had a news sheet come down to us down there or not. But I think bits of information used to be picked up and brought back, sort of thing, you know, and just to say how's the war going, and, you know, and this sort of thing, you know. But we was down there, and believe me, down there, when I say down there, you're finished. You're forgotten. You are forgotten. There's no getting away from it. I mean, even the people home here or anybody, they don't know. You're just forgotten down there. Western Desert, okay, you knew there was a war on in the Western Desert. Home here in France, you knew there was a war on in France. But when you got out there, no way. No one knew who you was, where you was, where you come from. You was a nobody.
So you didn't get newspapers?
No way.
What about mail? Did you get mail from home?
Yes, mail did get through a couple of times. I think, rightly saying, I did have a letter. Matter of fact, this photograph, what I showed you, was posted from down there. I sent that letter out to there to my sister-in-law. But I think I had a couple of letters come in from my mother. That's all. I'm the only person I used to have letters from anyhow, nobody else. And I didn't worry whether I had a letter or not, sort of thing. Perhaps once a month, twice a month. If it came, it came. I just read it. Everything was all right, yeah, as far as I knew. And that's all that worried me at the time. Because down there, you had nothing to worry about, only yourself. And that's all you worry about. Because it was a no man's land. And the termination of that, when they turn around and say, in East Africa, it's a white man's grave, you can believe me, it is a white man's grave, because no way would I ever go back anywhere in Eritrea or Abyssinia and live, because anybody that's out there now doing anything now, such as these missionaries and that, I think they're doing a damn good job out there, a splendid job, because no way would I go back there. Give me Palestine or Egypt, yes, but no way there. No. Regards of the lessons of the campaign, it taught us a lot regards of jungle warfare, which I think stood the battalion to good stead when they did actually go over into Burma, because that I did not go into, because I joined the paras in India. But after that, and they went into Burma, which I have seen many and many of the chaps, because I still go to the reunion now at Brentwood, and they turned around and said that jungle warfare, I mean, they coped with it owing to being out in the Sudan. And they said, regardless of the benefit to that and what they learnt from that, it did stand a lot of them, I think, in good stead, because it, I mean, you come to get through in Burma, the tales I've heard. I mean, I've been on the edge of Burma, parts through it, but and that was more or less the same terrain down there as you cope with out there at times. So, I mean, if you can cope with it out there, you can cope with it there.
Did they mention anything in particular which they learned, which was a lesson about jungle warfare?
Camouflage and keep your wits about you. That is your two main things, believe me. Don't make yourself too conspicuous and keep your head down. That any jungle warfare, you've got to go through that as stealthily as a cat goes through anything, because if you don't, there's always someone on the other end waiting for you, believe me. And there is. And I say, on jungle warfare like that, you have got to be very, very careful and take things very, very careful. And I will say to anybody, even if they're going to listen to this or not, I don't know, but if they ever come up against it and they go out in the jungle or anything like that, do actually be careful in what you eat and drink, because you can snuff it like that. You can, honest. Food and water is a great aspect out there, but don't drink too much water, because that can give you colic as quick as anything. That's why I always go bundle on cold tea. And believe me, cold tea out there is one of the finest things to drink. I don't know why, but I don't know if PG Tips is going to get me on this or not. But
so you think that the cold tea kept you in good order?
Well, I don't know if a lot of people, get any of the old soldiers and all that, they'll always turn around. If they come around the cookhouse, if you're out in the desert or anywhere like that around the cookhouse, I bet 9 times out of 10, you'll always see a dirty old Dixie on the side of the stove, 3 parts full or half full of tea, cold tea. No matter what's floating on the top of it, you just skim that with a mug and it'll come up as brown as paper there. But it's good for you, cold tea.
Yeah. Does spice food and tea keep up well while you were in...
That is the mainstay out there, is tea.
That kept you going, did it?
Tea. Any soldier, don't matter who it is, whether they're out in a desert or whether they're out in a town or anything, always a cup of chow. Always for a cup of chow.
Did the supplies manage to keep up with?
Oh, that? Yes, we had a good supply of tea. Yeah, tea, we did have tea. Cocoa or anything like that, we could make cocoa or anything, but no way. I mean, tea, yes. I mean, bloke would empty his water bottle out and he'd always have a bit of tea on him. Could always come back to the cookhouse and we'd give him half a pound or so at night. We always had a box of tea.
And what about other supplies, other food supplies? Did that...
That always came with us in the ration, Laurie. I mean, it was cases and cases and cases, and I've done a dugout in Tobruk with cases and cases of bully beef.
So you never had any trouble with food?
I had no trouble. Bully beef and biscuits. You had them. Yeah. And eggs, if you can, like, you know, I mean, out in the jungle there, you might see a few peafowl running around or anything, might come across a nest with eggs in it. And they're as good as chicken's eggs any day. You know, either eat them raw or do what you like with them. And that's what we used to do.